message on the subject of fasting in our larger series on the subject of prayer with fasting. We began by looking at an Old Testament perspective on the issue, and there we discovered God's attitude toward fasting and his desired results from participating in this discipline. Then last week we looked at fasting from a New Testament perspective, and there Jesus taught that fasting is to be seen as a normal discipline to be performed without seeking any special notice, and that it is to be completely directed to God. Well, today I'm going to begin presenting a general overview of fasting, and because the Bible has so much on this topic, many examples and teachings concerning fasting, it's going to take us 2 weeks to complete. So I'm going to begin this morning and then finish next week, and you can see that the title for these sermons will be Practical Guide to Fasting, Part 1 this week and Part 2 next week. So these messages will seek to be more comprehensive in scope than the previous two sermons, but as the title suggests, I'm attempting to present the material in such a way as to make it simple to grasp and easy to apply to our lives. Before we look at any of the biblical data on fasting, I'd like to make some general observations concerning our societal attitudes toward fasting. I believe that it is fairly obvious as to why I want to talk about our cultural views. We live in a society that loves to eat. It's one of our greatest passions. I mean, think about it. How many times in the past week have you been too busy to stop and have three meals a day, perhaps even a snack or two in between those meals? Or how many commercials, how many billboards have you seen or heard related to food or eating? How often have you decided that the way to celebrate was to get together and eat? How many times do we have food at gatherings here at church, maybe hoping that it will attract a few to stay? And how many of us are hoping to get out of here on time so that our Sunday dinner plans will not be affected negatively? In more ways than we care to honestly admit, we have become a nation that revolves around eating. Now, I know there's always at least one skeptic in the crowd thinking, surely you must be exaggerating. We're really not that bad. Can you back this up with any facts? Well, I'm not going to give you a ton of them, but here's a few for you to consider. A 2017 report released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that almost 40% of American adults, nearly 20% of adolescents, are obese. The highest it's ever been recorded in U.S. history. Dr. Frank Hu, who is the chair of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health, said, "It's difficult to be optimistic at this point. The trend of obesity has been steadily increasing in both children and adults, despite many public health efforts to improve nutrition and physical activity." Now, to put this into a little perspective, the CDC study performed back in the years, and I don't know why they're grouped in several years, but anyway, a study done in 1988 through 1994 found that only 22.3% of the American adults were considered obese. And that's compared to, we're saying, 40 now. And the percentage of Americans who are considered to be either overweight or obese, you combine those together, is calculated to be over 70% of the American population today. That's all the statistics I'm going to give you. But I'm going to make a confession at this point. My confession is this. I have to admit it, that when I go into a fast food restaurant and order my value meal, and they tell me that I can upgrade it for just a little bit more, I'm really tempted to go for the bonus fries and drink. I mean, after all, it is a good deal, isn't it? I'm just trying to be fiscally responsible, you know? Anyway, I read this quote from Andrew Murray in the Message from Isaiah, but I think it's worth repeating here today. He writes, "In nothing is man more closely connected with the world of sense than in his need of food and his enjoyment of it. It was the fruit, good for food, with which man was tempted and fell in paradise. It was with bread to be made of stones that Jesus, when hungry, was tempted in the wilderness, and in fasting, he triumphed." Again, I think it's obvious that we are a nation very dependent on food. But it's not primarily for survival reasons. We use food, again, as a means of dealing with depression or anxiety. We grab something to eat because, well, we're bored. And it fills in the time. We go out to eat to celebrate a special occasion or to make an occasion special. But we rarely eat due to an actual physical necessity because we rarely cease long enough to need to eat again. Becky Tirabassi relates how the truth of her eating habits became a reality as a result of her experience of fasting. She writes this in her book, Let Prayer Change Your Life. "While abstaining from food, I was surprised to find out how important and pleasurable food really was to me. Because I was not eating, I realized how often I wanted to eat, one, simply for emotional comfort, two, to better enjoy a social gathering, or three, just to satisfy certain cravings." Then she says, "Without eating for pleasure or comfort, I became very aware of how dependent I had become on food for emotional satisfaction rather than as nutritional fuel for my body." Now, Becky's experience is not isolated or an exceptional case. It is the norm. We are habitual eaters, living to eat rather than eating to live. We have allowed our passion for food to determine our lifestyles, and since fasting, generally speaking, involves abstaining from food, we choose not to engage in this discipline because it would infringe upon our pleasure. Our preoccupation and our overindulgence in eating has created a corporate fear of not eating. Because a majority of Americans have never experienced true hunger, we have manufactured this urban legend about what will happen to us if we fail to consume food in our bodies at those fixed times throughout the day. We have this unfounded fear that we will starve or we will harm our bodies if we don't keep an unbroken, steady stream of food entering into our mouths. We misinterpret the sensation of a lack of bloatedness as a sign that we had better eat something soon, or we may face the possibility of emaciation within the hour. And consequently, our identification with and our addiction to food, let's call it what it is, has resulted in an aversion to the notion of fasting. Anything that suggests an alteration to our accustomed and preferred mode of living is rejected or at least frowned upon and avoided. It is viewed as being too rigorous, too severe, too not for me. And this is true of even those who say that they believe in the inherent benefits of fasting. Dr. Neil Foster, he's a former executive vice president and publisher for Christian Publications, makes these remarks concerning many Christians' attitudes toward fasting. He writes, "Some say, I believe in fasting, but I don't feel led." It is true that we should be led as God's children, but he asks this question, why is it that so few Christians are led to fast when it is so obviously a vital part of Christianity? Usually we fail to fast because the whole concept of fasting has remained uninviting and uninspiring. Fasting has not been presented as a holy, and that's whole as W, okay? Holy, delightful discipline. And he concludes, but that is what it is. I want to move on now to describe then this holy, delightful discipline. And the outline for the remainder of this message and the conclusion next week is going to follow that age-old practice of good old-fashioned investigative reporting, and I'm going to try to attempt to answer all of the questions surrounding the matter of fasting, the who, what, where, when, why, and how of fasting. So I'm going to begin with what this morning. What is fasting? One dictionary defines fasting as to eat sparingly or to abstain from some foods. And this is the typical outlook of the average person, whether they are a follower of Jesus or not. Fasting, it's all about food, and specifically not eating food. And there are legitimate reasons for holding such a perspective, even from a biblical standpoint. See, when we consider the Hebrew and the Greek words associated with the act of fasting, we find that their most fundamental understanding is that they do not go beyond this idea of abstaining from eating. The Hebrew word translated as fast literally means to cover the mouth or to abstain from food, and the Greek word translated as fast means not to eat. And so we're not going to gain a lot from studying these words in the original language to get the true significance of what fasting is all about. And so in order to gain a clearer understanding of the importance of fasting, we have to look at the context, the larger context in which the word is found. What are the attitudes and actions associated with biblical fasting that point to its significance? Those are things we're going to need to look at. And that's the reason I began this series of messages focusing on two passages of scriptures that dealt with the heart of fasting. And we saw there the key component in both of those passages is that fasting focuses on seeking after God, pursuing Him and His will for a particular matter. But I want to go on to consider a few other definitions and see how they bring out a fuller conception of fasting. The Holman Illustrated Bible Dictionary states, "Fasting is the laying aside of food for a period of time when the believer is seeking to know God in a deeper experience." Another definition goes this way. "Fasting means to be so consumed with a matter that it becomes more important than food. And therefore, the believer sets aside food in order to concentrate on seeking God about a matter." But as we examine fasting in greater detail. What I want to do here is I want to open up our minds to the idea that fasting can be true fasting and have nothing to do with abstaining from food. And some of you are, yes, I want that fast. Yeah, no. Now, I know this might be a stretch for some of us, but I believe it's the case. See, fasting generally is about abstaining from food, but not necessarily. Listen to this alternate definition. Fasting is a disciplined abstinence from all that gratifies or satisfies the flesh in order to give oneself totally to seeking the Lord in the Spirit. This is the ultimate. Anything less is partial. I'm going to give more consideration to this broader definition of fasting and its practical implications next week. So I'll delve into those practical sides a little bit more. But I want to end this section of answering the what by giving you my definition of fasting. Now, I have given you a description of true fasting in the previous messages, and that was from the perspective of the heart or the motivation behind fasting. And now what I want to do is I want to give you a more mechanical or technical definition. And what I've tried to do here is to take all the various distinctives of this discipline and then form them into one concise definition, which we'll look at in more detail in a moment. But I'm defining true fasting this way. True fasting means to lay aside any pleasurable and/or vital activity for a period of time in order to intensely pursue God and know His mind with the intent of obeying His revealed will. So I'm going to look at each little phrase in that definition. The first one, to lay aside any pleasurable and/or vital activity. Again, I don't believe fasting is to be limited to the abstinence of food. Particularly, practically any meaningful activity can be considered as appropriate candidate for fasting. And in our little discussion this morning, our Koinonia group, we were talking about some different kinds of things that people have fasted. So setting aside any pleasurable or vital activity. The second part of the definition, for a period of time. And this is very important. It's not to be approached as an open-ended pursuit. I don't think it's wise to go in, I'm just going to go and keep fasting until I hear something. All right? There should be an established beginning and ending in mind with an openness to shorten or lengthen the fast as directed by God. But I think you should go into it with some predetermined time. I'm going to do this for a day. I'm going to skip lunch. I'm going to go 7 days. The next part, in order to intensely pursue God, and this is we've talked about the heart here, the focus of the fast must be upon seeking God. He is the only worthy object of a fast. And again, I really feel like fasting just to fast is just some diet fad, okay? There needs to be prayer. The normal means then of pursuing God during a fast would be through prayer and reading His word. I think that's the parts to add together. And why do we do it? The next part of the definition, to know His mind. Earnestly pursue God and to know His mind. It's a time for seeking a fresh revelation from God with regard to this matter which initiated the fast. And then finally, with the intent of obeying His revealed will there. And again, it speaks to the fact that there's a full expectation that God is going to meet me. There, we saw that when we looked at Jesus's teaching that your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you, that He will show up. So we are expecting, on the one hand, God's going to show up, but then when he shows up, it also suggests that the one fasting is then going to adjust themselves and come into alignment with what God says. A willingness to change in order to become a full participant in God's plan. And so it's with this working understanding of true fasting that we will continue our investigation. And I just want to look at one more question this morning, and that is who? And that is, who fasts? Maybe some of you are thinking, is this really that big of a deal that we're even giving so much consideration to fasting in the first place? Well, I want to take a look at some of the Old Testament examples. I want to look at some New Testament examples, others through church history, right up to the present time. And I'm going to tell you right now, don't be afraid. It's not going to be, there is a very long list. I'm not going to give you that very long list there. This is so, and my list would not be exhaustive anyway. But just a few Old Testament examples. If you grew up in church, you're very familiar of when Moses went to receive the Ten Commandments. It says he was up on the mountain for 40 days there and no food. In fact, no food or water. This was right out there. This is a miraculous type of a fast, not recommended for anyone in this room. But while he was waiting for that, he fasted. Over in 1 Samuel, Jonathan, who is Saul's son, fasted. It tells us that because he was grieved at his father's mistreatment of David. So there was a time he fasted. David fasted different times. One of the times he fasted was when the death of Abner took place, and he knew that was a wrong thing. And he also fasted when he was seeking mercy for his child, who Nathan told him was going to die. Elijah fasted for 40 days also, and he was traveling to Mount Horeb to meet with God. That's in 1 Kings 19. Again, real quick, Ezra fasted as he mourned over the unfaithfulness of those who returned from exile. Nehemiah fasted when he heard about the condition of Jerusalem while he was in captivity himself. We looked at the story of Esther, and we know that Esther called for all the Jews in captivity to fast while she was preparing to go and meet with the king. And then just one final and another person we have looked at, and that's Daniel. Daniel fasted as he was seeking God for revelation and for understanding into some matters. So there's some Old Testament examples. New Testament, real quick, at the birth of Jesus, we're told there was a woman at the temple named Anna, and she had a lifestyle of fasting and worshiping the Lord there. Jesus fasted right at the beginning of his ministry, 40 days, and we're going to look at that a little bit, and we're going to see that the type of fast that Jesus probably was involved in was what we would call the normal fast, where you go without food but not without water. Jesus probably was drinking water during this time. Paul tells us in numerous places in the book of Acts or in his letter to the Corinthians that he fasted a number of times. It was a normal part of his lifestyle to fast. The prophets and teachers there in Acts 13, it tells us that they were fasting and worshiping the Lord when the Spirit revealed to them, set apart Paul and Barnabas. So there was a time fasting. And then Barnabas himself, he fasted, it tells us in Acts 13 and in Acts 14, when he was faced with this task of appointing leadership in the churches. So different examples of fasting there. Let's move on and consider some examples of individuals who have fasted throughout church history. And I've just taken a little quote here from Bill Bright, who many of you will know as the founder of Campus Crusade for Christ. He is with the Lord now. But he gives this brief account of people who are known for fasting. He writes that down through the years, godly people who have done mighty things for God have testified to the necessity of prayer with fasting. John Wesley, who shook the world for God during the Great Awakening that gave rise to the Methodist Church toward the end of the 18th century, is representative of such great spiritual leaders. He goes on to say, he so strongly believed in the power of fasting and prayer that he urged early Methodists to fast every Wednesday and Friday, and in fact, he refused to ordain anyone in Methodism unless they agreed to do it. Other great Christian leaders who have made prayer with fasting a part of their lives are Martin Luther, John Calvin, John Knox, Jonathan Edwards, Matthew Henry, Charles Finney, Andrew Murray, and many others. Now we move on to talk about contemporary examples, because there is such a taboo on talking about one's personal experience of fasting, there is not a lot of documented resources displaying the names of Christians who are in the practice of fasting. Now, I am acquainted with a number of believers who do fast as a normal part of their Christian experience, but their names, of course, would be meaningless to you because you don't know any of them. However, I can give you a list of a few who are well-known Christians living today that have practiced or are in the practice of fasting. And one of those would be Richard Foster. You may be familiar with his book, The Celebration of Discipline. One who is no longer with us is Bill Bright, that I mentioned just a moment ago. But Becky Tirabassi, she is an author and noted speaker on prayer. These are some people that I know you may have heard of. I know that there are many others who are in the habit of fasting, but again, I'm not sure that telling names of other people that you don't know would mean anything. I'm going to stop here this morning, and we're going to conclude this message next week, and next week I will address the questions of where, why, when, and how. So I encourage you to continue to pray and to search out the scriptures concerning your participation in fasting.